we decided a while ago that we need to not only adopt AI, but also understand the potential of what it could add, with a deep belief that at the end of the day, tools are not replacing creativity, even though they're creative.
Welcome to Barriers to Entry, the podcast where every episode we get into it with the leaders, the designers, the early adopters, and the influencers who are driving innovation in the architecture and design industry. It's the metaverse, it's artificial intelligence, the blockchain, and it's all happening right here. I'm Andrew Lane. I'm a co-founder of Digbee along with my fellow co-founder, Tessa Bain, and our wonderful co-host, Executive Vice President at Sandow Design Group, Mr. Bobby Benet. Tess, Bobby, welcome. How are you guys doing today?
Charmed.
Charmed by the intro or just generally speaking charmed?
Yeah, I was charmed by the intro. I mean, Mr. Bonet, that was really well read.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel charmed.
It was well read.
Are you going to tell me Mr. Bonet is your dad? Is that the...
Well, actually, I was overhearing a conversation the other night at a bar where there were some older gentlemen sitting next to me who were referencing the fact that this generation, I say in air quotes, does not refer to their parents as Mr. and Mrs. anymore. They refer to them as first names. So when I see, you know, my daughter's friends, I'm always Bobby, which is totally fine by me. So I was caught off guard by the Mr. Bonet, but ultimately I felt charmed by it. So thank you. Thank you for that warm welcome.
I really appreciate that. I try to act like the older generation whenever possible. As
elder millennial, as we've established.
As Tess will often attest to, as she'll often attest to.
That is very true. Yeah.
So, what kind of exciting conversations do we have on tap for us today, Bobby?
Well, today we're excited to welcome to the pod an industry visionary who is expanding his prolific work in New York to a global audience. Having completed more than 50 buildings in just over a decade, Iran Chen is the leader of ODA, thought leader on the future of urban cities, approaching design holistically. In addition to rethinking how public spaces can be remade through collaboration with both communities and government, the firm is also actively reimagining the technology and tools that are needed to do groundbreaking work and scale a firm to reach global clients. In addition to all of that, the firm's forthcoming monograph, ODA, Office of Design and Architecture, will be released this coming spring, and we couldn't be more thrilled to welcome Iran to the podcast. Hey, Iran, how's it going?
Thank you. Thank you, guys. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Bobby, thanks for being so well prepared with that answer to my question.
Well, I mean, the alley was beautiful. I decided I just needed to go ahead and oop it. So thank you for the tee up.
No trouble at all. No trouble at all. So Iran, you know, you've obviously have a bit of a reputation that precedes you on the pod. So we're excited to have you on. And, you know, ODA has made a name for itself by designing spaces holistically, you know, working together with communities and governments. And, you know, this is something that's groundbreaking in terms of the way that you're imagining these built environments. Can you talk a little bit, just to kind of get us kicked off, about how you're seeing the way in which technology is now entering into these conversations, that it's having an impact on how you think about those collaborations?
Well, absolutely, Andrew. I think that it's interesting to kind of frame the conversation about technology and architecture. Just say that you're well aware of the ongoing conversation in our industry about the difference between revolution and evolution. While both of them are actually talking about the same thing, changes over time. Revolution means a lot of change or radical change over a short period of time, while evolution is, you know, slow motion steps of change. And it's very interesting to me in the context of technology of architecture, because as we all know, by the time that we've all seen and witnessed the revolution of the AI, you know, the internet even proceeding to that, if you look at that period of time, the past, whatever, 25 years, there was very little evolution or revolution on the architectural side. And at the same token, if we think of some of the most brilliant buildings that we all cherish and love and actually are very relevant today, some of them have built 100 years ago. And so there's some disconnect between qualities of architecture and the pace by which, you know, technology is changing. And it's hard to talk about revolution in architecture, but definitely evolution is required for us to keep up in the way we live and in our cities with technology. And to that end, I think, to me, one of the most interesting aspects is how technology have changed the way we behave. And in the most simplistic terms, You know, technology allows us to do anything from anywhere these days. We really don't need to go anywhere to do anything. We obviously can work from home. We can consume culture. I remember growing up, you want to watch a movie, you have to go to the cinema. You want to watch a show, you have to go to the theater, right? You want to buy a pair of jeans, you go down to the main jean store in your town, you buy a jean. Clearly, none of that is true today. If we're hungry, we can order food. And that means that there's something very substantial changed in the way we've seen modernism in design in general. Because Louis Sullivan has kind of coined the term that form follows function, as we all know. And we keep on referring to that as if that's true today as well. But what happens when the lines of what program or function starts to blur to a point where, you know, it's not that clear what is the function of a particular place? Mm-hmm. What is the form going to follow if not the function or the program? And so I think that a lot of that ties into what I call form follows experiences, which might sound like semantic, but in true, I think, is a revolutionary thought process for architecture and design today, where if today the program of a building doesn't really matter as much, because we can probably do anything we want on any given space, what really matters is the type of experience that we as people have. And the only driving force that gets us out of our house these days is the type of experiences we look to just, enhance. You know, me personally, I live in Tribeca. I love walking, in neighborhoods of New York City without any goal, particular goal or means. By the way, if you go into Italy, or if you go into the High Line, or if you go into the streets of, you know, Little Italy stuff, it's just an urban experience that we're striving for. So can we start thinking about our buildings in those terms as well?
How has your perspective shifted in the last 3 or 4 years, you know, maybe kind of post-COVID? Because you just referenced the idea that something to draw you out of the house requires maybe something exceptional. And that might not have been the case as much 4 or 5 years ago. So have you found that the way in which you're looking at the environment and the way in which you're looking at experiential design and the idea of form following experience has changed in the last couple of years? Or have you had that perspective for a longer period of time?
This kind of concept have formed in my head, and I think at ODA we keep on discussing that in the past 3 or 4 years. I'll give you an example. We've been asked to design an office building in Buenos Aires. And the office building kind of situate between the Central Park of Buenos Aires, called Palermo Park, and the racetrack. It's definitely not a location for an office space, but it was an existing parking garage that the city owned, and they didn't know what to do with it. So they reached out to the private sector and says, you know, you can build any commercial institution, if you will, come up with ideas. And so when we looked at that challenge, the function of an office building per se, meaning, you know, how much floor area you're going to have and, you know, where are the corner offices going to be, was not even in our mind. What we thought was, how can we create a unique experience in and around that building that would draw people to want to work in that location?
Right.
And the resolution to that architecturally was that we ended up cutting 20% of the existing building, repurpose or relocate some of this area, and basically created a ramp that goes from one side of the building to the other that connects the park at two dead ends and allow the public to go up to the roof of the building openly and freely, look at the open view of Buenos Aires, enjoy a restaurant and event space, and continue down. And that, you know, monumental ramp is what shaped the entire outcome of the building. The experience of public coming through a building, over the building, experiencing the city, experiencing the views through kind of an urban landscape on a building is what shaped the building itself.
Kind of going back to Bobby's question about post-COVID, are clients coming to you looking for that kind of ideation? Is that stuff that you're tending to need to let them know and express to them that it's important? Is it kind of in the middle? Just curious if you're seeing a shift in that sort of client attitude towards the importance of drawing people in the way that you speak about it.
I mean, honestly, I would say most of our clients, we still need to kind of push those ideas across and also to explain the feasibility of them. And it's important to understand that this is not just an experience for the benefits of all, just so we have fun. Our argument, my argument is that these kind of things create value to the buildings themselves. So for me, it's an easy sell for a developer, for example. Because if you have a building that otherwise would be a typical office building, nobody really needs these days, and you replace it with an unbelievable, exciting place of gathering, that would draw the customers. That would draw, you know, his tenants, with a developer's tenants. That would help developers to sell for more, to rent for more, and to bring value to their real estate. And so most of the clients don't think that way still. You know, I would give you another example that is very common. New York City, the retail ground floor traditionally was considered very valuable. And if you have any conversation with a developer 15 years ago, you know, you'd face an Excel sheet with values based on floor, and the ground floor would be the most valuable because retail was supposed to be the most income producing element. But now it's changed, right? The spaces are standing empty. People are barely being able to rent them. So when I come to some of my clients and I say, why don't we give up that ground floor? Erase it from your Excel sheet altogether. And in lieu of that space, we're going to expand the sidewalk, expand the public realm, create a sort of a covered garden. We'll bring kiosks of artists and food and beverage, and you're not going to make a dime on that. How about that as an idea? And they're like, well, you're out of your mind. But then I say, well, think about that. If you think about that, if we do that, we create value to all of the floors that are above, because now all of a sudden, if you have a tenant for an office space, they would rather be in your building than in the building next door, because it has that excitement underneath it. If you build a hotel, this is where people would want to come, because right underneath, there's this exciting thing going on. And so the value, it's very easy to sort of explain almost in dollar value how the rest of the building enjoys the sort of the sacrifice, per se, of the ground floor.
And never more important to consider that sacrifice, so to speak, than right now, when in a city like New York, it's harder and harder for commercial buildings to get folks to want to come into the office and spend the day in the office.
Correct.
And having a payoff like that on the first floor, where whether you're in Buenos Aires or in New York City, you'd like to experience that art installation on first floor or the culinary cuisine of the day on your lunch break, there's more of a reason to actually leave your home office and make the trek to Manhattan.
Exactly, Bobby. So that's where the full circle comes together. We said that what would drive people to get out of their house and come to work at the office? If that's an incentive for an employer, which I think it is, what would propel people? So, you know, we know we're recognized the old forms of Google and technology world that had ping pong tables and billiard tables in every corner. And that's what one form of experience, correct? But I think the urban experiences are much more revolutionary. They're new and they're more attractive. The building in Buenos Aires, half of it was leased immediately to the highest paid technology company in Buenos Aires because they thought it's the coolest place to be. Because if you work there, you are totally engaged with the idea of an accessible park on your roof and food and beverage in every level and the ability to drive your bike all the way to your office, et cetera. So these kind of engagements are definitely the new attraction, and what I call experiences in city are kind of a win-win situation for all.
Hey, listeners, it's Bobby and Andrew from Barriers to Entry. You do not want to miss our episode with Lisa Gralnick from IF Design. If you're a fan of Barriers to Entry, this episode should be at the top of your queue. Bobby, why do we love this episode so much?
Well, Lisa was my favorite presenter at South by Southwest 2024, and she took us behind the scenes of her part at South By, and it's going to go even deeper in our conversation with her.
Yeah, amazing conversation about innovation, about sustainability, and about a European award that's about to take the U.S. by storm.
Make sure to subscribe or follow Barriers to Entry wherever you get podcasts to hear our episode with Lisa Gralnick and to be notified when new episodes drop.
Thank you. So to put some of this stuff together, and you'd mentioned it previously, you know, you had a government building who reached out to the private sector, and that's a big part of what it is that you've kind of really built your reputation on. Can you talk a little bit about that secret sauce in terms of bringing those kinds of partners together and really selling the kinds of narratives that you're sharing with us here?
Yeah. So one, I would say, you know, governments and city planners across the globe are starting to think this way also. For example, the city of Seoul, the collaboration of the mayor and the city planner, have decided that there's not enough quality green shaded public spaces across the city. And they're all consolidated in particular parks, but the actual experience of the linear retail in main streets with 8 lanes of cars is not as exciting any longer. And so they reached out to the public sector and said, listen, developers, we're open for a competition where every developer can come and offer a unique use within their own private land that would expand the public realm, that would have a meaningful contribution to the city. And in return, we're going to give the winner, that developer, 20% additional floor area and 20% in height. And that's a major, major proposal from a city planning. And so I got a phone call from one of the biggest developers in Seoul, and they said, can you help us? This sounds like a very exciting thing. And what we proposed essentially is to build at the base of the tower, which originally was planned as a 3-story retail shopping mall-like thing, to create a porous base that includes very little program. It has some retail at the ground floor, but the rest of it would be a very playful multi-level garden space, which would include galleries and exhibition spaces. We would tie the building amenities to that space as well, so it becomes an amenity for the building. And then we'll take that floor area from the bottom and shift it to the top, where it's much more valuable. And the city will gain this urban connection, because it also connects 2 streets, 2 sides of a neighborhood through the building. Will, you know, become an iconic placemaking for the building itself, and it's a win-win situation. So I see more and more of those formulas emerging, and I think that in the next 10 years, we're going to start seeing increasingly private sectors providing those kinds of experiences to the public.
At what point in the design creativity process, the planning process, when you're working with the city in that facility, do you find that your partners on the urban planning side have the aha moment and they're like, Iran, that's, you know, we got to do this? Because I'm sure up front, there's a little bit of changing hearts and minds based on the ways in which they're accustomed to approaching a project like that.
Yeah, it's like, I got to admit, this is a struggle. And sometimes it's an uphill battle where you think as an architect, as a creator, that you're bringing a new type of quality to an urban setting. But some teams in the urban planning, they're not used to it. So they have a hard time putting it in a box and giving it a definition. You know, we had that experience in Queens, Innovation Queens, which is a huge master plan we've done in Astoria, where the developer really reached a wall with the community. They tried to get an upzone. They couldn't get an upzone or a consensus. And we said something similar. We said, let's take 25% of your private land, which is, by the way, 100,000 square feet, over 5 city blocks in Queens, and let's fully dedicate those areas as different types of outdoor gathering for the public, for the benefit of the public. And in addition, we're going to take the entire ground floor that you put a huge value on, and we're going to give it to community facilities within the neighborhoods, art program, F&B, local businesses. And the developer had a hard time to accept that in the beginning. But I said, listen, if I'm successful, you're not going to lose an inch of floor area. We're going to move all of that to the top. But this is a new narrative for the city and for the community. And once I reached the point of agreement by the developer, I went to city planning in New York City. And New York City city planning was kind of astonished by my proposition. They're like, they couldn't know what to do with this. They're like, what is the definition of that space? It's a private land. You know, it's a park. Is it a courtyard? There's nothing in the zoning book that describes it. you know, I'm sorry, you can't do that.
That sounds positively terrible for a city employee to have to deal with as a problem. It's not in the zoning book. We're done here.
But it's truly the process that we need to all kind of go through, which is what are the new definitions for those places? If we want to be radical about Midtown Manhattan and how we convert all of these 70% of the Class B and C office buildings that are old and empty. Mm-hmm. And we're only going to say the only formula is to convert them into residential. We miss the opportunity and we miss the point altogether. But if we start imagining a porosity at the ground floor and beyond, where the building kind of can become voids within the structure to accommodate totally different new type of activities and creative industries, cities would have a hard time to accept the definition of those spaces, to regulate what they look like, maintain them, how they're going to be safe. So there is a process here that we all need to go through in order to achieve that. But I truly believe that that's the only way to address some of those old, you know, dated infrastructures that are not relevant anymore.
So in the, you know, past years, I'm sure that 3D renderings become a critical part of the ODA process. And when you're having these conversations with private sector, with public, with government officials, I mean, how are you using renders and this technology to communicate your messages and other ways maybe we haven't even thought of?
No, I think it's an excellent question, Tess, because we used to present sections and facades and, you know, and drawings, and that's internal use only. Any communication mm-hmm. that ODA has with the outside world, from our clients, the city, or any stakeholders, is done in 3D. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we're at a point where all of it is done through animations and videos. I rarely present a client with still images. We start any conversation about concept design through an animation where you're literally walking through a space. And that's a huge shift for us. Mm. We're using Unreal Engine, which is also kind of new, the ability to quickly create a three-dimensional animation that even though you don't know all the answers, you can still form. Again, the experience or convey the experience. And we take our clients through this, either through videos that are pre-subscribed or even through VR headsets and allow them to walk through our spaces. I think that becomes mainstream.
How have you found the VR headset adoption with your clients? Is that something that's not for everyone right now? Or how are you doing some hand-holding there?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because a few weeks ago, I'm not going to mention a name, but one of our best clients, who is one of the most familiar faces in New York City development world, who does some of the most cutting edge real estate development. We are designing a major tower for them in Midtown Manhattan. And we brought all the equipment to the office. He's used to, actually, he doesn't even like looking at the screen. He's used to flipping through drawings like the old-fashioned way. And we said, would you mind? We have a surprise for you. Come put those glasses on and we'll take you to a tour through our building. And this was such a comical experience. I mean, it took a while for him to even understand what this is doing. I have to admit that he felt a bit unbalanced and it was a bit fuzzy in the beginning. He took them off and then put them back on and took them off and put them back on. But after a few minutes of getting used to this sensation, he really loved it. He really loved that because there's nothing that is even comparable in the ability to experience these days. How are you going to feel in a particular space? How are you going to walk through it? What kind of light is going to shed on you? It's quite powerful.
Well, we had the opportunity to take a look at the video for the Soul Project that your team created. And it really is impactful sort of seeing the skyline as you approach slowly and then really understanding what those public gardens almost feel like from the point of view of actually approaching a building.
Yeah. And imagine that we've got that model ready already. And this is just concept design. We didn't really fully design the building yet. And not only that, we're showing the video to the client, we then hand him the VR headset that says, let's walk together from the sidewalk and go up, you know, that garden and look down into this shopping center and then take the elevator up and go up to that mid-level garden and look at the city around you. It's quite incredible.
And are you finding that that helps the conversation when you're bringing forward such a, you know, a radical different idea to ground floor space? Are you finding that that helps kind of move that conversation along with your client?
I have to tell you, once we pass the financial hardship conversation, and that's the one that I pointed out before, is like, what, are you crazy? Are you going to take my most valuable real estate and I'm going to put a garden? Yeah. Once we pass that threshold, and it's very easy to explain. I think anybody can do that these days because we're not proposing losing floor area necessarily. You're just moving it, reallocating it to places that they're more valuable. And two, any kindergarten kid can understand that if you have a 50-story tower and one floor of ground floor, the value added on all of these floors accumulatively is much higher than what you might lose in theory at the ground floor. Once we pass that threshold, there's a lot of excitement. And we've seen great success in communicating that narrative and huge enthusiasm by the clients to try to execute that dream, which is to me the key to every architect's way of convincing any clients to do anything, right? We have to sell a story that the client loves so much and connects so much that the process, in the process, which is all painful as we know, the client is your partner in trying to save that narrative and you're not fighting consistently. And that definitely, those tools definitely help to do that.
I have to ask, while we're on the topic of kind of the narrative, the story that you're talking about, obviously you're becoming quite known for this approach. This might be too secret of a sauce, but is there a way that you're measuring that ROI of creating that garden as opposed to having the J. Crew on the ground floor there? Like, how are you thinking about it now that you're getting more and more projects in your portfolio? When people come and say, well, how successful was that when you did it 5 years ago? What are some of the ways that you're showing that return on investment for people who have taken this leap with you?
Yeah, I quantifying success in architecture is always a bit challenging because there's so many factors that might come into play where you say, oh, this was a super successful project. And somebody might say, well, it's not because of the garden, it's because the market was great, and so on and so forth, right? But I think it's a consistently commercial success throughout our projects that brings the clients back. It's not one trick or one conversation of convincing one or two clients, where you have a lot of people, smart developers, who keep on coming back after they went along with the experience. That's a big sign for everybody else that there's a reason why they're coming back. And we're very proud of that we have returning clients that went with us through some experiences and experiments and have seen the results financially and otherwise. You know, there's an old project we've done in Brooklyn. It's kind of a full block residential rental building. In a way, you could say it's kind of a typical New York City rental block in Brooklyn, not a high budget or anything. And our entire argument was that if we're going to shape the roof, instead of being flat, have peaks and valleys. So it's like this three-dimensional landscaped forest, if you will. Then on every floor within the building, you're going to be able to connect directly from your corridor to the roof because the valleys would bring the roof down to you. Which means that when you build a huge building, instead of having endless corridors to get to your apartments, most of them are dark, right? You have natural light in the corridors and you create a circular behavior where people can go out straight from the third floor, walk up the garden, go to the top of the building, take the elevator down, and so on and so forth. That experience has value and people would appreciate that. People would enjoy it and you'll get better rents for it. I mean, that's a strong concept, but it's a hard argument to make for a developer who needs to pay for it.
And it's hard to argue with better rent.
Exactly. But what we find over time that building performs much better than all of the other buildings next door. If over time, 5 years back, the developer comes to us and says, you know what, I don't know if it's the garden, I don't know what it is, but we still perform 5-10% better than all of our neighbors. And we have less exchange of tenants and people love being in the building, then maybe what you said is correct and definitely it was worth the money.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Let's shift gears a little bit, or maybe push the ball forward a little bit on the technology side, Iran. So we talked about virtual reality. Let's kind of tackle AI for a moment. I'm wondering where ODA is leveraging AI, or maybe you personally, we're seeing some possibilities, whether it's part of the design experience within the firm, or you obviously are extraordinarily thoughtful as it relates to the client experience, where you see AI positively impacting the client experience for your firm.
Yeah, so Bobby, needless to say, AI is going to revolutionize our industries. And I'm the first one to say it's already, I think, doing so in so many ways. And it's a scary thought for a lot of us because the first thing that comes to mind is AI is going to replace us. And where is the place of creativity where the computer is more creative than you? So with that scary thought in mind, we decided a while ago that we need to not only adopt AI, but also understand the potential of what it could add with a deep belief that at the end of the day, tools are not replacing creativity, even though they're creative. So we started playing with Midjourney in the beginning. I don't know if you know that software. It was sort of the first one that you kind of create images based on words. And we tried it in many different ways. And one day I was kind of scrolling through my Instagram and I see this guy who posts these unbelievable architectural images that clearly are kind of imaginary. And he calls himself Shael AI. And I said, oh my God, how does it do that? These are really unbelievable, well-composed, strong ideas, imagery that are clearly regenerated by AI, but they were very kind of intentional and thoughtful. So I reached out to him. And apparently it was a young kid from India who was maybe 17 year old. And he was very happy for my known reach out. And I said, look, I really appreciate what you do. I think this is unbelievable. Would you mind if I hire you to share some of your secrets and maybe share with us your process? And of course, he was very happy to do so. And we spent some time with him. And what we found during the time is that what we're using today is Stable Diffusion algorithm. And then what we do is we build our own kind of script to build upon that, where we are using base imagery. A lot of it has to do with the library of ODA international projects throughout the years. Hundreds of thousands of images that describe what ODA is about is becoming the source of inspiration. And then, of course, a grasshopper with words description and try to build what we think is a conceptual thought, not a building, not construction documents, but a concept building. And we find it extremely powerful right now when it comes to interior design. If you practice interior design, let's say hospitality or residential, you start with a mood board. And that's pretty typical. And in the mood board, what designers are doing, they're harvesting other people's images to put together a mood to describe an idea for a client. That's almost pre-concept. Before you actually design something, you create a mood board. And today, the Stable Diffusion algorithm helps us to create a mood board that is much more sophisticated, that is much more diverse and interesting, and that it's built on ODA look and feel. But I got to tell you, the impact of this is incredible. I have no doubt in my mind that on the interior design side or any concept design mood boards in the future, near future, everybody's going to use that because it's a powerful tool. And with the time, you also learn to control. You can control every inch of it. You know, people say, oh, but I can't control it. No, you can. If you tame the machine enough, and if you insert enough images, that becomes the library of inspiration that to direct it what you want to achieve, that it does the job.
So you mentioned a little bit about some talent that you found through your exploration in this space, but Can you talk a little bit about how you're thinking about talent more broadly at the firm? Like, obviously, you're growing, you're expanding into new areas, and you've got all of these new technologies that are coalescing at the same time. So how's that changing the way that you think about particularly the younger people, the young talent that you're bringing into your firm moving forward?
I have to say, I don't think it has changed in principle that much, because for us, the first idea is to find talented people who are aligned with our general idea about architecture. Not the form, not the style, but the idea. And so when I talk about porosity for prosperity, when we talk about, you know, expanding the public realm, when we talk about buildings that are doing more for the users, or, you know, the idea that form starts to follow experiences and not only function, these are the topics we speak about consistently at the office. And these are the type of conversations we have with creative young people. And then we are looking for their capabilities in terms of their know-how of technology, the softwares that they're using, or anything else to start translating those alignments into reality. But yeah, the tools have changed. And, you know, now I'm much more curious about, you know, a young candidate to understand, you know, Stable Diffusion or Midjourney, or at least kind of know what we're talking about. I think that becomes important. The Unreal Engine was not something we used 5 years ago, but nowadays it becomes super relevant.
So you're seeing it more as like an embedded, newly embedded skills rather than just completely different types of talent, is what it sounds like. Is that fair to say?
I think so. Yeah. I don't think it's a different type of talent. I might be wrong, because maybe developing the AI in the future would require a slightly different talent that is much more in editing, or the ability, for example, to verbalize ideas through words and communicate that to the AI might become a needed talent. I don't know to say at this point, but I'm hoping that it's not going to be the case. I think at the end of the day, it's the same idea, the same talent. It's just that we have to keep up with technology and understand what's going on.
Love that. Bobby, is it time?
I think it is. Iran, really fascinating to hear about some of the projects you shared today that you've been working on between the public and private sectors, the journey you go on to bring some of those visions to life. We'd love to give you the opportunity to talk about whether it's book that you have coming out, or any other initiatives that you're working on personally or you're working on as part of ODA. So plug away.
Well, thank you. I think that, we cover a lot of ground. I would say that our new book, ODA, Office of Design and Architecture, is coming out in March this spring, and we're super excited about that. It's interesting because one might ask, well, with all this technology and scripting and three-dimensional visualizations, what's the value of an architectural book these days? But I still think that the book is almost like a diary of our work in the past 5-6 years. It really accumulates and compose visually some of these ideas we discussed today through built work mostly. And we're super excited about this. So we hope that a lot of you are going to get excited and get a copy.
I was just going to say, I'm requesting a signed copy.
We love a coffee table book.
We love books at Interior Design Magazine and Metropolis Magazine, right. So we're looking forward to it as well.
Fantastic. No, we're super excited about that, and I think we're going to put our hands on the first copy in the end of February, and definitely we'll send you I promise we'll send you a signed copy for all three of you.
You've heard it here. That's amazing.
Yes. It's on record.
Well, we always like to end every episode just by asking our guests what piece of advice that you would give to our listeners or a resource that you would share to them. So for people that are looking to get into this space or learn a little bit more, or even just, you know, some sage wisdom from you, whatever you prefer.
Well, since I spent some time teaching, I teach at Columbia University at NYU, I think the idea of educating younger generation to still be attracted to the world of design, the world of architecture. There's so much going on in this world on technology and, in other sectors. And I don't want the young generation to feel that architecture or design is an old man's occupation. There's so much excitement in this project. It's an endless fascinating profession where you deal with people, with social complexities, and you bring technology into it in a way that promotes the quality of our life as people now and in the future. I just think it's one of the most, still one of the most fascinating work to do and a life journey to pick. And I really just hope that a lot of people would continue and be drawn into that profession.
Eran, we do want to really thank you for the time spent today. I mean, this was a fantastic episode. Amazing to learn about the process. We really appreciate you drawing back the curtain. I think quite a bit for our listeners to learn about today, you know, bridging from technology, embracing technology within a firm, the client experience, and then bringing forward a vision and bringing that vision to life. So thank you very much for joining us today.
I did really want to call out just the storytelling approach that you take even to the process of getting the project off the ground and getting the buy-in. I think that's something that you hear all the time from people who have a lot of success in whatever field that they're in, is like you really have to bring people into the narrative, and the way that you've been able to do that across public and private sector, how you've incorporated technology into it. Just kudos. I think that's really an exciting way to approach it. And it's exciting to see that it's been so successful for you. So really appreciate you sharing that.
Thank you, guys. It was a pleasure. And thanks for the opportunity. I really enjoyed every minute of it. Thank you, Andrew, Bobby, and Tessa. And Rob, thank you, too.
I'll send us home with a big thank you to the Barriers to Entry production team, our producer, Rob Schulte, and everyone else back at the studio by Sandow. Barriers to Entry is part of the Surround Podcast Network. Make sure you go to surroundpodcasts.com. That's podcasts with an S. Smash the follow button and join us next time as we continue to break down the barriers to entry.
We're having an audio issue from the producer.
Uh-oh.
Fix it in post, Rob.
Yeah.
We'll skip the stage with Rob.
You just
there you go. This is for the outtakes.